Feelings. Nothing more than feeling. Trying to forget my feelings of love.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. That original recording of Feelings by Morris Albert has been heard thousands of times, thousands around the world, and we take it at face value. But the refrain, nothing more than feelings, suggests perhaps a simpler notion of the concept when, in fact, feelings or emotions could be the highly complicated constructs of each individual. Sadness or joy for me is different than it is for you because it's based on a wholly individual frame of reference. Ditto lust, anger, irritation, and impatience are any manifestation of human emotion. That's a sliver of the message in a new book by Northeastern University Distinguished Professor of Psychology, Lisa Feldman Barrett. She is a neuroscientist with appointments at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital in Psychiatry and Radiology. Her book is entitled How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, Lisa Feldman Barrett.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
You contrast your conception of emotions with the classical view, the one we've been taught to accept for generation upon generation, and it's been around, like I said, a long time. It's so much a part of what we accept. What is the classical view that you're talking about there?
Sure. The classical view is the idea that somewhere lurking in the deep animalistic parts of your highly evolved brain, there are these circuits, one for each emotion, anger, sadness, fear, and so on. And that something can happen in the world, say a snake will slither by, and it will trigger the neurons in your fear circuit. And as a consequence, you will make a particular facial expression that everyone in the world not only can recognize, but also makes themselves. So kind of widened eyes and looking really startled. Your body will take on a particular pattern, so your heart will race, maybe you'll sweat, and you'll prepare to run or freeze, and that there'll be this characteristic feeling of dread or terror. The idea is that this is an obligatory response that all of us have. Everyone in the world has these circuits for emotion. Even other animals have them as well. And that they're really part of our animalistic nature. They're given to us at birth. We don't have to learn them. We may have to learn how to regulate them, but they're kind of, you know, part of the general operating kit of that we're born with.
Where did that classical view come from in the first place?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We've traced it all the way back to ancient Greece with Platonic ideas of the human mind. So Plato wrote about a tripartite psyche or mind, the idea that we have appetites like hunger and sex and thirst and so on. We have emotions like anger, sadness, and fear. And that he depicted these as two wild horses that were controlled by a charioteer, a human, which depicted rationality. And the idea that there are different emotional capacities and that each of them has some basis in our animalistic nature really has been, you know, to be controlled by thoughts or rationality, really has been carried through in almost every theory of emotion throughout antiquity and certainly into the modern age. So even the idea of how the brain is structured, for many years, scientists believed that, you know, we had an inner lizard brain. You know, people still actually use this idea
in
the industry. Yeah, exactly. That we have a lizard brain, which is where our appetites live, the Platonic appetites. And then, you know, surrounding that is a limbic system, which is an ancient limbic system, which is where our emotions live, kind of the home of our inner beast. And then this is controlled by the cortex in the brain, which is where rationality lives. This idea, as iconic as it is, and as, you know, it seems like common sense, actually was debunked in evolutionary biology almost a century ago. We know that brains don't evolve like sedimentary rock. that the cortex doesn't sit on, you know, the animalistic parts of your brain like icing on an already baked cake. In fact, the way that brains evolve is that as they grow, they reorganize, just like companies. They need to stay efficient, so they modify their organization. And what we've learned is that the efficiency of the brain and the way that it's structured to be efficient, to be metabolically efficient, gives us a very different picture of how it works and really how the brain is able to construct the emotions that we experience and that we see in other people in the drop of a hat.
And not only on top of all of that, we've also learned really in the last 20 or 30 years how plasticity plays a role in that our brain is constantly changing. This isn't an evolutionary concept. It's evolutionary from one individual's beginning of life to the end.
It's actually both an evolutionary concept and a developmental concept.
Okay.
So from an evolutionary standpoint, when you look at one of our adaptive advantages as a species is that our infants are born with their brains, you know, not completely wired. So, you know, a little infant brain is not a miniature adult brain. It's a brain that's awaiting a set of wiring instructions to wire itself to the physical and social surroundings that it will grow in. So one of our great advantages as a species is that infant brains develop, they learn, they are wired themselves not only to the physical surroundings they're in, how often they're fed and whether they're kept warm and so on, but also to the social surroundings. That is, how often do you look at your infant? How often do you make eye contact? How often do you cuddle? How often do you speak words to the infant? What words do you speak? What concepts are you transmitting into that little infant brain in order to wire it in a particular way? And in the same way, as we grow and as we change, our brains, you know, may not be as plastic as an infant's, but it certainly is plastic. And we do, when we learn new things, we are essentially rewiring our own brains. And so, for example, when you go from one culture to another and you learn something new, which is called acculturation, you may learn the practices and values of a new culture, the emotions of a new culture. You are actually rewiring your brain in a very similar way to what occurs in development.
We know that they study the brain now with those live scans to see what part of the brain is at work when someone is watching a scary movie or a violent video game or something like that. What are we seeing in those cases? What's happening?
Yeah, so we see a couple of really interesting things. The first thing that we see is that there isn't a single part of the brain that's dedicated to anger or sadness or fear, right? So what we see instead are a set of networks that are kind of domain general. What I mean by that is it's not the case that every neuron does everything, but each neuron in the brain does more than one thing. So you have these networks, think of them like common ingredients in the same way as, for example, in your kitchen, you have flour and water and salt, and you can make a lot of different recipes with those basic ingredients, and some of them aren't even food, right? So for example, you could make glue that way. In a similar way, you have these networks in your brain that have particular, very general functions, and they work like general ingredients to make not only instances of anger and instances of fear and instances of awe and happiness and gratitude and so on, but they also make thoughts and memories and perceptions. So one thing that we see is the importance of understanding emotions as a whole brain phenomenon. You know, this idea that you only use like 10% of your brain is at any given time is kind of a cool idea for science fiction movies and cartoons, but it's actually not really the way your brain is functioning.
So that's that outdated understanding of brain function. Is this just among lay people, or is this, you know, what are we on the cusp of here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way I think of it is kind of, you know, there's this old saying, a fish in water can't see the water that's mm-hmm. all around them. mm-hmm. And I think the classical view in science has been there for a long time, so much so that sometimes scientists don't even realize when they're using it. Similarly, this idea that, you know, if you have a distinct experience of anger and that's very distinctive from another experience of, say, sadness, that somehow that should those two experiences should originate in different parts of the brain. That idea that different parts of the brain are like little mental organs that do different things has also been, you know, this assumption that's also almost invisibly been directing how scientists do research for a long time. But in the past decade or two, but mainly in the past decade, I would say, there have been real innovations in neuroscience and to some extent in psychology that lead us to a very, very different view of how the brain is creating the mind, that the mind is a computational moment in the brain, and that instead of starting with these experiences that we have and go searching for their location in the brain, instead we can look at how the brain is structured and how it functions and ask, well, what kind of emotions can a brain like this produce? What kind of a mind can a brain like this produce? And how, not where, but how is the brain doing it? It's kind of a revolution in science.
Does everybody agree with you on this?
Absolutely not. It wouldn't be a revolution. A revolution happens when not everybody agrees, right?
You're the vanguard then.
Yeah. So what I would say is that, you know, if you look throughout the course of human history and you look at scientific advances, you almost always see, it's the case in biology, for example, in physics and chemistry, that science started with a very common sense understanding of how things worked. In science, we call this naive realism, the belief that your experiences reveal to you how things work. So we saw that, you know, the sun rises in the east and it moves across the sky and it sets in the west. And this led to, you know, a belief that the sun revolves around the earth. So in science, in every science, every revolution has taken us away from these common sense ideas towards a more complex understanding of how nature works. And I think that that's what's happening now in psychology and in neuroscience and in all of the sciences that deal with the structure and function of the human mind and brain and body.
And the way you structure your, there's so many things that this affects. It affects everything. It affects military. It affects the legal system. It affects psychology, of course, education, everything.
Absolutely. So in my book, I have tried to pick just a couple of examples. I have a chapter on emotion and the law, a chapter on child rearing, where we discuss child rearing, where we discuss the health and really the breaking down the boundaries between physical health and mental health. You know, it's not the case, for example, that the systems that are involved in depression somehow cause physical illnesses to be more likely. It's that really that the systems that are involved in depression are also involved in physical illnesses. They're like common ingredients, if you will. And they're definitely, you know, any place where emotions are relevant, you know, there are serious implications for understanding really how the brain is creating emotion. And I would even go further and say, as I do in the last chapter of the book, that, you know, we're just using emotion in a sense as a flashlight to understand how the brain and the body are creating the human mind. And so the concepts that I introduce in this book that have a lot of science behind them, right? So when I say it's a theory, I don't mean it's a set of ideas. I mean it's a set of ideas backed up by a lot of scientific data, really hold for understanding a whole host of phenomena that that you may not immediately think of as having anything to do with emotion per se.
We're talking about where emotion comes from. My guest is Lisa Feldman-Barrett. She's a distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University. Her new book is entitled How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. If you have a question or comment for Lisa Feldman-Barrett, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out the Facebook page and post your question or comment on the Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's by my.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. So what does good vibration mean to you? For me, it refers directly to this high energy harmonization. And for me, that feels good for many reasons, many of which I may not even be aware of. We're talking about where emotions come from, how they're made. My guest is the author of a new book on the topic entitled How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. She is a Northeastern University Distinguished Professor of Psychologist, a neuroscientist with appointments at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital in psychiatry and radiology, Lisa Feldman-Barrett. Welcome again, Lisa. I appreciate your time.
I'm delighted to be here.
That idea of where our emotions come from, you know, we think something makes us smile because someone told us a long time ago that when this happens to you and you get this kind of feeling, that's when you smile?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we have this idea about emotions like they're our reactions to the world. You know, we're reacting to stuff that happens in the world, little bombs go off in our brain, and then, you know, our emotions take us over, sometimes causing us to do and say things that are, you know, otherwise ill-advised. But actually, if you look at the structure of the brain, you look at the structure of the nervous system, what you see is that your brain is not reacting to events in the world, it's predicting. Your brain is constantly guessing what's going to happen next. It's using past experience to guess what's going to happen next, and these guesses are the basis of your emotions. And this happens entirely outside your awareness.
How do you know what's happening outside of it? I mean, how did you come to that conclusion?
Yeah, well, I can tell you it wasn't from a single experiment. It was really by studying, first of all, anatomy, looking at how neurons are structured together and looking at evolution, looking at how brains and nervous systems have evolved, looking at the physiology of brain function, so the metabolism of the brain and also little neurons and also the electrical properties of those neurons and what's possible. And then, of course, there are actual studies, not just in non-human animals, but also in humans, brain imaging studies, and some behavioral studies as well by studying people's experiences and also measuring their behaviors and so on. If you look at the structure of the brain and you look, so first of all, I'll say one thing that's really interesting is that one of the main constraints on brain size and structure is metabolic efficiency. Brains are really expensive little organs. They take up about 20% of our metabolic budget, even though they only weigh about 3 pounds. And metabolic efficiency is really important to a properly functioning, well-functioning brain. And it's really more metabolically efficient for your brain to guess at what your body's going to need in the next moment and try to anticipate those needs and meet those needs before they arise, as opposed to trying to react. So let me give you a couple of examples here. One is really simply if you're sitting down right now and your brain wanted you to stand, your brain would have to change your blood pressure, raise your blood pressure so that oxygen could get to your brain as you stood up. If your brain were to change your blood pressure after you stood up instead of before, so instead of doing it predictively, it did it reactively, you'd faint. Similarly, if you were playing baseball, for example, and you looked at the ball consciously, saw the ball, where the pitcher threw the ball, and you were looking, tracking the ball consciously, and based on your conscious awareness of where the ball is, attempted to prepare to swing your bat, you would never be able to swing your bat and hit the ball because it takes almost a full second to make the motor plan to swing the ball and to actually lift your arm and swing. So baseball as a sport, tennis as a sport, in fact, every sport that involves a ball would not exist if we had reactive brains. Instead, your brain sees where the ball is. It's predicting where the ball is going to be in a moment from now, and it swings at the predicted location. So, you know, that's why the interaction between batters and pitchers is so interesting. The pitcher is trying to get the batter to mispredict where the ball's going to be, essentially, and have a strikeout. And this doesn't just describe how this dynamic doesn't just describe how we play baseball. It actually describes pretty much how the brain works and how the brain is making emotion. So to you, it may feel like you're reacting to events in the world, but in fact, your brain is making guesses using its past experience. It's making guesses about what is about to happen in the next moment and what to do about it. And oftentimes, those guesses are the basis of emotion.
What does that tell us then? Going back to the fainting issue, there's that physiological thing going on. What does that tell us then about people who, say, have a needle phobia or a blood phobia and they faint when they go to give blood or something like that?
So they're already – so let me back up and say one other piece of this. Mm-hmm. So when I say that the brain is anticipating, it's guessing, I don't mean that it's that this is some abstract thing that the brain is doing. The brain is actually – starting to modify the firing of its own sensory and motor neurons before sensory input arrives. So, for example, if I asked you, Anne, right now to keep your eyes open and to, in your mind's eye, imagine a red Macintosh apple of the sort that you would eat, and maybe it has a little bit of green in it. Can you imagine, can you see in your mind's eye that apple?
Yes.
Okay, so right now, certain parts of your brain are causing the neurons in your visual system to change their firing in the absence of an apple. That's why you have that ghostly image in your mind's eye of the apple. If I ask you to imagine holding the apple in your hand, taking a bite of the apple, can you hear the crunch as you bite into it? Can you imagine the taste of the apple, maybe, you know, it's sweet with a little bit of tartness. Can you imagine those sensations?
Mm-hmm.
So again, your brain is actually changing the firing of its own sensory and motor neurons to allow you to imagine that. For example, this happens to us all the time. You know, if you've ever had a song that goes through your head that you can't get rid of, that's your brain modifying the firing of its own auditory neurons in the absence of any auditory input. Your brain basically does this all the time. And if I were to actually pull out an apple and show you the apple, it would then use the sensory inputs from the apple to correct whatever its prediction was. If you imagine the apple exactly as it was going to be, then no new information from that apple would make it very far into your brain because your neurons are already firing to capture it. Your prediction becomes your experience. This happens all the time. And so what's happening to people when they go to have a needle, since they've had a needle in the past or they've read about having needles or they've seen people who've had needles, they start to predict, we use another word, simulate, the experience of what it's going to feel like when the needle pierces their skin. And they actually the brain starts to construct that experience before it actually happens. Just in the same way as when you go to drink a glass of clear liquid, you pick it up and you take a drink, and if it's not water and that's what your brain was expecting, it's really startling to you because, you know, your brain was already causing its own neurons to fire to prepare the experience of tasting water. Just like right now, it seems to you as if you're listening to the words that I'm speaking, but in fact, based on your years and years of understanding English, your brain is actually predicting every single word that comes out of my mouth. And if I were to say out of my ear, right, or out of my mm-hmm. nose, it would have been very, very surprising because that's not what your brain was preparing you to hear.
Is that what is happening when they say, if you can read this, and all the letters are all jumbled up?
Yes. And you know the cool, like, there are these really cool YouTube videos where they'll play music backwards, like Stairway to Heaven, and they'll put the text on the screen, and then it does. You can really feel like you can hear the words that are being played backwards. You can really feel like you can hear something in those backward playing music when the words are on the screen. It's because the words are actually creating the predictions that allow you to hear the sounds. They're actually adding information that's not there to allow you to hear something that is otherwise would be a jumble.
You say that if you didn't know an emotion, you wouldn't feel it or see it in others.
Yeah.
So how do you get to know an emotion?
Yes. Yeah, so one of the ways that people learn emotion is when they're children, people label emotions for them. We name objects in the world and little animals and so on and so forth. We also label emotions for children. We label our own emotions. We label their experiences, their actions as emotions. And this is actually how children learn concepts when the instances of the concepts are highly variable. So there are some things, you know, in life where the category of things is pretty similar to every other instance, you know, like a face, for example. You know, all faces, for the most part, have two eyes and a nose and a mouth, and they're kind of in the same orientation. And we're very expert at faces because we've learned what a face is, you know, moments after birth. We've had tons of experience with this. But there are other things that where the instances of the category are very highly variable from one another. So, for example, if you think about the category of anger, you know, you do lots of things in anger, right? You can tremble in anger, jump in anger, yell in anger, scream in anger, gasp in anger, attack in anger. You can even laugh in the face of anger. Also, it's the case that people don't just smile when they're happy. They sometimes smile when they're sad. They don't just cry when they're sad. They sometimes cry when they're angry. They don't just smile when they're happy. Sometimes they scream when they're happy. And so in order to make sense of all of this variation, we essentially teach our children emotion words, and that helps them make sense of all of the variability in emotional lives. It helps them to not only to be able to understand what anger is and sadness is, but also to be able to make those emotions and perceive them themselves.
You say that, except that when I was reading what you said about autism, for instance, how a lot of times that's a real line of study for somebody, particularly high functioning, that they have to learn about emotions. You said that's not necessarily very helpful.
Well, that's not exactly what I said.
Okay.
Yeah. So here's what I would say. We're all born with the capacity to feel pleasant or unpleasant, to feel worked up and really agitated or feel really calm. Those feelings come from the sensations in our bodies that we don't experience in very high dimension, in very high detail. We experience our bodies pretty much in these more general, what scientists call affective ways. But everyone has to learn how to make emotions. Everyone has to learn emotion concepts. Most neurotypical brains that are wired in the typical way, learn that automatically by interacting with people in their culture. Not all cultures actually have concepts for emotion, and in those cultures, people make sense of their bodies in the world in different ways. But in autism, one of the problems in a brain that is of a person who is on the autism spectrum is that that brain is not wired to predict very well. It's not wired to use past experience in a way that can predict the immediate future. And it's very hard for people with a brain that is wired in a non-neurotypical way, if you're on the autism spectrum, it's very difficult for those brains to learn how to group together instances that are highly variable. So for them, it's hard for them to learn that people can smile when they're sad and cry when they're angry and scream when they're happy. So scientists on the belief that, you know, there's one facial expression for happiness, smiling, one facial expression for anger, scowling, one facial expression for sadness, pouting, decided to see whether it would be helpful to children who are on the spectrum to learn these faces, to learn to recognize a scowling face as angry, to learn to recognize a smiling face as happy, and so on the assumption that if they could learn these expressions, then that would help them read emotions in other people, and that would help their social functioning. The problem is that most people don't scowl when they're angry. I mean, when's the last time you saw anyone win an Academy Award for scowling when they're angry? In fact, when I think about all the people that you see on television, I can only think of one person right now who scowls quite a bit, who's on television a lot.
Archie Bunker?
That's not the person I was thinking about, uh-huh. But he's one.
Yeah.
in the news quite a bit now at the moment.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Most people don't scowl when they're angry. Most people only smile when they're sad, when they're happy. And so children who are on the autism spectrum can learn to identify a scowling face as angry and a smiling face as happy. The problem is it doesn't generalize to their social functioning outside the lab for exactly the reasons that I said. With emotions, variation is the norm. You don't do one thing in anger. You don't do one thing in sadness. Your face doesn't do one thing. Your body doesn't do one thing. And so teaching children that there is a single expression for anger and a single expression for sadness is not helpful.
And when we do it with just kids, I mean, we've all seen those little books with young kids that teaches them that very thing. And it's very one-dimensional. Most people grow up to understand that not everybody who scowls is angry and vice versa, right?
Yes, because a neurotypical brain can learn, it can learn about variability just automatically. It doesn't need always direct instruction. But a child who's on the autism spectrum doesn't have a brain that automatically learns that way. And that's one of the reasons why they have such a challenging time socially.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how this fits into the U.S. justice system, psychology, and so forth. So stay with us. My guest is Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a distinguished professor of psychology at Northeastern University. Her new book is entitled How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We certainly had fun with the music today. Have you ever had that happen to you, a time when you can't fight a feeling? My guest this hour, noted neuroscientist and distinguished professor of psychology, Lisa Feldman Barrett, has written that perhaps you can fight the feeling that you are not a passive receiver of sensory input, but an active constructor of your emotions. Her new book is entitled How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. So can you talk about that a little bit, Lisa Feldman Barrett? I mean, that is, if you're aware of all of this stuff, you can consciously fight the feeling.
Absolutely. So this is what I would say. Changing how you feel in the moment is really hard. Fighting the feeling in the moment is super hard. Most of us are not very good at it. Sometimes maybe we're a little better than other times, but it's really, really hard. That being said, understanding how the brain works, understanding its predictive structure, really widens the horizon of control for you And it gives you a whole set of tools that you maybe didn't know that you had to be a better architect of your own experience. So if it's really the case, for example, that the things that have happened to me in the past, my brain can use them to very automatically to make predictions in the present for what will be my immediate future, right? So my right now, as I'm interacting with you, I even though I can't see you, and even though we've actually never met before, I've done a bunch of interviews. I've certainly listened to many interviews on NPR, and so my brain can use this information to make predictions about what you might be thinking and feeling, even though I can't see you. It's also making predictions about what I may feel next. And if that's really the case, if it's the case that your past becomes the ingredients for your present, then your ability to cultivate new experiences in the present become one ingredient for your emotion to make your emotions in the future. So cultivating new experiences, for example, in the present, seeds your brain to automatically make new predictions in the future. It gives your brain more flexibility to make predictions that will allow you to be better adjusted to whatever the situation in the future is. So for example, if you go into a business meeting where you're interacting with someone who typically makes you angry, you can cultivate in the moment, invest the effort to cultivate a different experience that then it makes it easier for your brain after in situations in the future to feel something other than anger. That's just one example of something that you can do. You can cultivate, be the curator of your own experiences, experience more instances of a given emotion like anger, or learn new experiences. There are a whole set of emotion concepts from other cultures that our brains can make by combining concepts that we have. If you practice that, you become really automated at it, and it makes your experiences much more flexible and better tuned to the situation.
You write about the impact of our classical notions of emotions on the U.S. legal system, which assumes that thoughts and emotions are separate in the brain. What's the significance that they are entwined and very, very complicated?
Well, I wouldn't even say they're entwined. What I would say is that the ingredients in the brain that make emotions also make thoughts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes both emotions and thoughts are made pretty automatically. They're made without any sense of effort or agency from you. And in the law, it tends to be the case that that the theory of mind in the law is that emotions are automatic, and that the behaviors that occur as a consequence of automatic emotions, or as a consequence of emotions, because they're automatic, you're less responsible, you're less culpable for the negative consequences that may occur, whereas thoughts are very deliberate, they require a lot of effort on your part, and so therefore you're more culpable. But, you know, as I said, emotions and thoughts can be made in a very automatic way. They can also be made in a very deliberate way. You can put a lot of effort into your brain doesn't just make a prediction about what emotion it will make, but it corrects based on whatever's going on in the situation, which is what we experience as deliberate effort in making an emotion or making a thought. And, you know, but you never see anybody who is given a less serious sentence because they had a fit of thinking, right? Even though thoughts can be very automatic. Also, we see a lot of cases where emotions are very deliberate, and the idea that people should be less responsible for the harm that they cause in those situations, is really questionable. There are also, in the book, I discuss lots of other ways in which the classical view of emotion is somewhat problematic. So, for example, in our legal system, there's the assumption that in order to get a fair trial, a jury and judges have to be able to know the hearts and minds of the defendants. But if it's the case that there are substantial cultural variations in how people express emotion, which there is, then if you have jurors who are from one culture and you have a defendant who's from another culture, you have an immediate problem in just implementing a fair trial.
Well, that happens every single day then.
Absolutely. It does happen every single day, which is why I wrote about it in the book.
Yeah, I mean, because even you referred to the Boston Marathon bomber in the book, and I'm thinking, you know, that could be cultural differences between a region, between being out in the country and being in the big city kind of a thing. There's so many differences.
Absolutely. There are a huge number of differences. And when I wrote about the Tsarnaev case, and I should just point out, you know, two things for your listeners. One is the Boston Marathon bombs went off a mile from my office.
Wow.
The bombers were caught not that many miles from less than 2 or 3 miles from my house. And I am not making a statement here as a juror or as a legal actor. I'm just telling you as a psychologist and a neuroscientist that Tsarnaev came from a culture where remorse isn't expressed in the way that Americans express it. And if it's really the case that in order to get a fair, I'm not saying he didn't get a fair trial, but the jury recommended a death sentence on the basis of the fact that he didn't, as opposed to life in prison, on the basis of the fact that he didn't express remorse. But the fact is he didn't express remorse in a typically American way. And I'm not making any comments here about what that means about whether he deserves the death penalty or not. I'm just presenting the facts as I know them from scientific research.
Because in some cultures, the visual manifestation of remorse may not even exist.
Yeah, in Chechen culture, which is where Tsarnaev was from, where his family was from originally, and where he was very identified, I guess, with that culture, there's this concept of the Chechen wolf, which is, you have dignity in defeat, and you don't. It's disrespectful both to your family and your own culture, and to your opponent, basically, to be overly emotionally expressive. Doesn't mean that you don't feel remorse. It means that you don't express it. In many cultures in the world, there is a big distinction between what you feel inside and what you show on your face or in your actions. In anthropology, this is called opacity of mind. It's the idea that there are rules for how you behave in certain situations, and those rules for how you behave have nothing to do with how you feel. Therefore, you can't really determine how someone feels by what they do in those situations when there are these, you know, very strict rules. And even in some cultures, it's kind of seen as disrespectful to infer what someone is thinking or feeling based on their actions when the rules are so set in stone.
Iris in Columbus, you're on the air with Lisa Feldman Barrett. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I wonder, first of all, how the studies, the author has in the book, how that would impact cognitive therapy, because basically, you know, that you use your intellect or rationale to analyze emotions. So how would it impact that? And then specifically, earlier when she was talking, she referred to the kind of a mind that your brain creates. And I wonder what she meant by that.
Okay.
Well, Iris's question about cognitive behavioral therapy is a question that I often get. And what I would say is that what's happening in cognitive behavioral therapy is that you are learning to cultivate different experiences and to perform different actions in a situation which eventually your brain will be able to use automatically in the future. So it's what you're taught to do essentially is to search for prediction error. And so your brain is making predictions that maybe don't fit the situation very well. And cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness meditation, and mindfulness also does this too, helps you to pay attention to other things in the world that is our prediction errors that your brain might have ignored. But instead, you pay attention to them, you learn them, and then your brain is able to use them eventually very automatically in the future instead of having it be so such an effortful correction in the moment. So the explanation for cognitive behavioral therapy that your thoughts determine your feelings is not so correct, but the actual implementation of what you do in cognitive behavioral therapy perfectly fits the idea of the predicting brain and how it's structured. To answer Iris's other question, the way to think about your brain is that, or the way I should say that scientists think now about the brain, which I find very helpful, is to think of the brain as a structure that is made from billions of neurons that are all networked together. And this structure is bathed in a chemical system, neurotransmitters they're called, which changes the ease with which the neurons talk to one another, the ease with which they pass information back and forth. What this means is that your brain, even though it's one structure, can take on trillions and trillions and trillions of patterns. Those patterns are the experiences that you have. They're your thoughts and your feelings and what you see and what you hear. And those patterns direct the internal systems of your body and they allow your limbs to move. So instead of thinking about the brain as a bunch of mental organs where this region does this thing and that region does that thing, you can think about your brain as a complex system. When I say complex, I don't mean, wow, this is super complicated. I mean complex as in your brain can take on trillions of patterns, and those patterns really are what you experience in the moment. They are your thoughts and feelings and perceptions.
I have an email from Marty. I know you maybe can't address his specific question, but maybe give him some thoughts about how to do it. He says, my parents have been gone for 36 years and 13 years. Why do I react differently to their birthdays and death anniversaries? Sometimes I am okay and sometimes I am very sad. There are no patterns to my grief over the years. I was 17 when my father passed away and 40 when my mother passed away.
I guess the simple thing that I would say is that the way that our brains predict is very contextual. And when I say contextual, I don't just mean what's going on around you in the outside world. I also mean what's going on inside your body in the moment before. So our brain, one of its main tasks is to control the systems of our body. And if you for example, if I have someone come into an experiment and they are tired, they haven't eaten very much, and maybe it's allergy season, so they're feeling kind of cloudy-headed because, you know, their nose are stuffed and they've been taking, some kind of anti-allergy medication. They're going to perform a simple task, you know, just even a reading out loud or a task of recognizing simple images. They'll perform that task really differently than if they've had a lot of sleep, if they had caffeine before they came in, and so on and so forth. Now, that may seem to you as if, you know, the physical systems of your body may have nothing to do with how you feel about your parents passing away. But in fact, as I said before, a lot of what we feel from our bodies has to do, we experience the sensations from our bodies not as specific sensations, but as feeling pleasant or feeling generally unpleasant or feeling distressed, feeling worked up, feeling calm. That's one context that influences not only what we think, but really literally what we see. It affects our predictions really, really intensely. We show this in the lab all the time.
Well, as predicted, Lisa Feldman-Barrett, I don't have enough time to ask all the questions I want to ask, but I certainly appreciate your time today in answering them.
I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you.
Lisa Feldman-Barrett, Distinguished Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University. The title of her new book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. That's it today. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.